Margaret Tracy voyaged down from the U.S. to Brazil back in 2014 for two reasons. First, for the adventure. Second, and these are his own words, for being irrationally convinced that he'd be successful. In the end, Parker stuck the landing. He took his experience in the auto industry to create Cobly, a startup that builds technology for fleet management. Now, Cobly has over 5,000 clients and investors such as Fifth Wall, the IFC, and SoftBank. In this episode, Parker and I talk about how to balance curiosity and focus as a startup founder, the story of how Parker landed in Brazil and co-founded Cobly, how to balance founders' and investors' interests, and the importance of product channel fit. My name is Brian Reckworth, and this is Latitude Podcast. Vamos Latam.
Parker, great to have you on. It's good to have another American that's voyaged down to Brazil and, you know, been in the throes of starting a company. You got to be a little crazy to do that, right? So we were just talking about kind of the capacity to be, you know, super analytical and calculate risk. And you said one of your kind of superpowers might be that you're willing to just jump into things and kind of figure it out, paraphrasing what you said. But maybe you could describe briefly what you're kind of like, where your skill set resides and what you're just amazing. What are you world-class at?
Yeah. Also, I think world-class is an aggressive word for my response is going to be here. But I'd say that there's two things. The first is kind of what you touched upon is that I think saying I'm risk seeking is the wrong word. I think I don't think about risk. And I think if I did think about risk, I would probably be much more calculated and probably more risk averse. But I jump into things without any notion that it will go wrong. And I would say that extends to things beyond business and stuff like that. So I would say I'm risk oblivious as opposed to risk seeking. And I think that describes a lot of founders, right? You just are oblivious to the downside and the upside. You have this romanticized Disney-esque vision of what it actually means. And that creates a really awesome risk reward that you're really attracted to for going after. And I'd say that this, so I don't know if that's a weakness. I'd probably put that in the weakness category.
I think it's important for entrepreneurs, right? You have to have this optimism. So it sounds like you're just optimistic. And, you know, in order for you to do something crazy and painful, you got to believe in yourself and believe you can figure it out.
Yeah. I'd say the beliefs would be secondary. I just say there's a big pie in the sky and there's no way it goes wrong, right? It's and then having a light belief that I'll figure it out along the way without having any sort of realistic superpowers. But then the second one is I'm much more, think of the archaeologist comparison. I'm much more of an archaeologist, meaning like I like looking and finding and thinking about things on the horizon much more than I like building structure. And so thankfully, like my co-founder is much more a structure builder and we complement each other pretty effectively. But I think good founders are people who just have this like infinite curiosity and trying to connect nodes and stuff like that. And that is just like always sniffing for opportunity on the horizon. Right. And I think that's where my mind has always been kind of drawn to that. I think the combination of just being risk oblivious and an archaeologist ends up creating, I would say, maybe not the most successful founders, but definitely like people who want to be founders like permanently.
And so you have a business partner that is better at the kind of planning, blocking and tackling, and more like amazing operations, because that's obviously an important part. So you found, did you seek someone out that had those abilities? Like, did you have the awareness that you're like, okay, I need to find someone that like is really good at XYZ in order to compliment me? Or was it just like serendipitous? How did you think about that when you were, and did you recognize it in the early days that your partner would be your support in that and you guys could compliment each other?
No, I don't think it was quite as structured thinking as that. Obviously there's complementarity around just the way we think, we get along and stuff like that. And then the kind of the division of tasks just became clear as we moved on. We kind of just doubled down on our strengths as opposed to trying to like, you know, be this like super well-rounded tandem and stuff like that. So I think it was more kind of a development work in progress as opposed to some sort of like high level, top down macro understanding of what, you know, what are the pieces of this puzzle and how do they fit together?
When you're an archaeologist, how do you develop the discipline to continue focusing on your project, because there's always a new opportunity. There's always something else to uncover. So what's it been like for you, one, discovering where the opportunity, you're doing fleet management, you know, technology for fleet management. What was that discovery process like? And given that you've got this like deep curiosity, how do you stay focused on the one thing that moves the needle, which is the current business you're building?
Yeah. Well, I think very much by design, and consistent with the term archaeologist, is I like to look where other people typically aren't looking. So for example, I kind of have this rule, like if there's already lots of VC dollars in that industry or there's MBAs flooding, I run for the exit. Just because, you know, in the Peter Thiel, it's like competition is for losers. And so as long as you can find large, opaque spaces that are especially not hyped, that typically fall into like blue collar segments, industrial, physical things are all things that I really like. Just because tech largely overlooks these things. And so there is, you know, and as long as you can choose those spaces really effectively, you don't have to be the best operator, the best fundraiser, the best strategist. You just have to be better than the next guy up there. And I enjoy competing against family businesses and against old school industrial incumbents much more than I like competing against, you know, other SoftBank infused Harvard MBA founder types. That's awful. Right? That's just a race to the bottom. And so I think very much focusing on like your curiosity has to be tethered to something. It's just this like infinite curiosity. You just become this like, you know, your brain just floats into the ether and doesn't get anywhere. And so you at least need to have some kind of, what is the true north? What's the definition of I would say good places to play? You have to have that very clearly delineated and written down, and everything has to go through that filter. And then once you push that filter through enough, it becomes infrastructure of the way your mind works. And so everything that you're looking through gets pushed that through that filter. And it's very good at like, I don't know, just sifting out bad thinking and bad ideas and stuff like that. And then I'd say the other part is you have to just be prolific at writing, right? Like, you know, Stephen Sinofsky, writing is thinking. And you have to be just like an obsessive note taker. You have to be obsessive at writing and trying to put thoughts together, right? Because what seems really elegant and romantic in your mind, the second you put it into like an 8-bullet logical flow of why this is a good idea, it really, really removes a lot of bad thinking. And so I'd say the combination of those few things, right? Very structured curiosity and just an incredible urge to write everything down and try to have writing sift away bad thinking.
I like that. Yeah, you got to be really kind of clear, you know, clear-headed if you're able to articulate it to someone else in written form. It definitely demands a higher level of you know, thinking and scrutiny about the ideas when you sit down and write it. I'm a big fan of that. Do you find yourself writing like long documents kind of for yourself? Is that something you do like regularly?
I would say prolific note-taking, and then sometimes I'll pull those notes into like a memo, which I can send to my team, or just sometimes they're just writings that I enjoy for myself that I'll probably never publish. But I would say it's much more being a prolific note-taker and having that be a superpower than it is. It's less important to me to actually pull the thoughts together into a narrative than getting the thoughts down on paper.
Got it.
The paper is like the, you know, if you think of thinking as a data stack, right? You have to be able to like generate that data, right? Like see a lot of it. You have to be able to store it. And I think that's where a lot of people miss on the storage. And then obviously then there's like the thinking and analytical layer that sits on top of that like thinking stack. And if you have a bad like data storage system, you can't be very, very analytical, right? If you can't like very, very quickly recall a bunch of thinking that you had done in the past or experience that you had or insights, then it's very hard for your thinking to build on top of its previous thinking, right? Every single thought you have is like a brand new thought that doesn't actually end up building towards better thinking.
So you've co-founded a business before Cobly. You had a business that was in the US, a vehicle financing company, and a board member in that company. You didn't veer too far away. You're related to the car segment still. How much of an influence did that previous experience result in you building Cobly today?
I mean, very much, right? It's that's my only other. I started this company out of undergrad, so 17 years ago, and I'm still a large shareholder, still a board member, and had a ton of success. Right, we are one of the 10 biggest independent auto finance companies in America. Very profitable company, very big top line. Yeah, I think truly what I learned is unfortunately with that business, lending businesses are very odd businesses because almost all businesses are demand constrained. Like if you had 10 times more leads or 10 times more interest, you would grow 10 times as fast. Lending is not the case. You're always supply constrained, right? The complexity is how you capitalize the balance sheet. Everyone wants money, right? Giving away money is really easy. Obviously making it come back is a little bit harder, but the hardest part is actually capitalizing that. So I learned a lot of tactical lessons that weren't very applicable to what I'm currently doing. But I think I just learned how to like hustle, right? We've raised like $2 billion of debt, we have about $2 billion of securitizations. But we never raised any equity. So it was much more controlled cap table, which I think is much very healthy for a lender, right? It's the J.W. Childs, like famous private equity guy, goes, show me the lender that grows fast and I'll show you the lender that dies. And so it was very lucky that kind of the structure, how lending businesses work, are not very, I would say, congruent with venture capital. It was good because I think if given the opportunity, I probably would have stepped with VC and it would have been a really bad idea. I think I learned a lot. I learned hustle was probably the number one thing. There was an insane amount of hustling in the early years there, and it definitely led me to what we're doing. Like about half our loans are to businesses or to fleets. We focus on a huge part of our customer base are recent immigrants. That was actually the origin of the company. Is I want to create a financial services company for recent immigrants to the United States. And so we deal with a lot of Brazilians. We deal with a lot of fleets. You kind of connect the dots. Is like I clearly had a starting point and parts of my previous business that fed very clearly into Coldly.
Got it. Just on the topic of kind of fintech lending businesses in Latin America, there's tons of dollars, you know, backing a certain sector. You like to compete with like big traditional sectors that, you know, have old school competitors. So similar line of thinking, they were starting to lean a little bit on the lending side. Where do you think we are on the kind of the lending stack, given that you have a pretty large business in the US focused on lending? How do you see kind of the current state of affairs for fintech and lending businesses in LATAM, startups?
Yeah, I'm happy you make the distinction fintech versus lending. They're very different businesses, right? One is tech. Lending's fundamentally not tech. It's like tech enabled. So you're just trying to make decisions faster and stuff like that. So there is no such thing as a tech kit business that lends money, right? Your product is the money itself. It's your inventory. I don't like lending businesses in Latin America. I think lending is a much better business in the United States for two main reasons. First is it is very hard to capitalize a balance sheet. It's much harder to capitalize a balance sheet in Latin America than it is in the United States. One. And then two is you're always competing against an incredibly high fluctuating CDI, right? Or like T-bills that like your entire portfolio can literally just go underwater in the span of 6 months, right? Historic increases in Fed funds goes from like 0 to 4 or 5. Historic increases in Latin America can go from like 2 to 30. How do you have a lending business when you can't have a lending business like that, right? There's no variable rates in Brazil, right? They're all fixed rates. And so I think lending businesses, if you pull out the time horizon to 10 plus years, lending businesses are awful in Latin America. When you have a very small time horizon, like 2015 to 2022, I think you just caught a really, really amazing time where rates were really low. And it can be good, but I don't think lending businesses in general are very good in Latin America. Same someone from the lending world.
Let's change gears a little bit and let's talk about those first days of, well, first of all, this is the number one question I get when people ask me about my journey is like, how the hell did you end up in Brazil?
Yeah, so it's definitely the path was, my first business is an auto finance company that focuses on recent immigrants. And the fact that I started this company in Boston, I moved home from Boston. I moved home after college with my folks. All the immigrants in Boston are Brazilians. So from day zero of my like career, I was working with Brazilians. You know, at the time it was like speaking Portuñol and stuff like that. My Portuguese was like effectively like, you know, soccer references and swears and stuff like that. And then the fact that, you know, my First Help Financial, my auto finance business is, you know, an alternative lender. We went out to try to raise money in 2008. And naturally we have an alternative lender during the biggest subprime crisis ever. And so that's actually why I applied to the MBA to try to like hedge my bets and stuff like that. And so, obviously kind of had this connection to Brazil because my company is effectively just serving Brazilians in the early days because Massachusetts is all Brazilian. And then when I got to the MBA, which was like a mile away from my office, so I did the MBA and kept running the business at the same time. I entered in 2010 and graduated in 2012. So this was like the boom years. This was like the final years of Lula, like the real and the dollar were like tied. It was, you know, when the Christ was exploding, erupting off the, on the cover of The Economist, like it was like the future is bright. It's like just a matter of time before, you know, Brazil. I remember the term BRICS and that was a term back when like China and Russia were like well-behaved and never thought that developing markets were the future and all this stuff. And I super drank that Kool-Aid. And I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. I can like leverage some experience that I already have. I can use the MBA to try to like build a network. There were just so many macro things that seemed inevitable to me. And so I ended up getting down in 2014, like a few years after I graduated. And to found Copeland. That was essentially what I would say. It was 50% just the adventure of going down. And 50% was I was irrationally convinced that what I was going to do is going to be very successful.
Yeah, you got to start with believing in yourself. It's interesting because there was a pretty mass, you know, kind of movement of post MBA people coming down, but very few people stuck around and kind of made it and like, you know, and stuck it out, which I want to double click on in a second in terms of, you know, how you're able to kind of stick it out. But let's first talk about Cobly and the first years. When you went down there, was this the idea that you had? Did you go down with this thesis? Or did you kind of develop the thesis as you learn more?
Yeah, so the thesis was IoT is going to be a very big thing, right? So effectively, how do we connect the offline world to the online world so the two can interact more dynamically? At the very beginning, there's three business models connected to IoT. So the core technology didn't change, but the go-to-market, we were experimenting with go-to-market. So there's basically three. Is there a consumer idea here? Can we be a service provider to insurance companies? We saw that a lot of auto insurers were using telematics quite a bit. And then finally, fleet, right? How do we digitize fleet to help them solve business problems? We tested all three. The consumer idea was at the time two companies had raised an insane amount of money for a consumer idea, both then went to the gutter. And so we tested the consumer idea for like a month and we found there was like just no demand at all. Like no one wanted to track themselves. No one really wanted to get like better analytics in their car. They just didn't solve a real and recurring pain point. Our first paying customer is actually Liberty Mutual, like Liberty Seguros in Brazil, because they used us as their telematics technology. And what we found was while telematics is revolutionary to auto insurance, obviously you can price in terms of actual behavior as opposed to profile, like, you know, what zip code you live in should not be determined. What should be determined is how frequently are you driving in risky ways. We found that insurers, their underwriting technology is incapable of consuming telematics and there's regulatory issues and stuff like that. So it was very, very hard fit. And so we ended up focusing 100% on fleet. We started in fleet. We didn't understand how big the opportunity was. And I would say a year into sales, we super understood how big the opportunity was, right? It's 13% of the GDP of Latin America is logistics. And we wanted to sell something that's very fundamental to the digitization of these operations. And so I would say it was 2016, 2017, we were completely focused on fleet. And that's when we just, you know, start really understanding the go-to-market motion, which is very different than those other two ideas that we had experimented with.
It seems like so many startups begin with the B2C model and then they go to B2B. Why is B2C so hard in Latin America?
I think B2C is hard everywhere. I think, look, what you're trying to do is you're trying to say, what type of revenue do you want? You want the revenue that's the most valuable possible revenue. What's the definition of valuable revenue? It's high margin and recurring. That's the best. The opposite of that is low margin and spot, right? Meaning that you have to regenerate it every single time. Almost everything consumer fits that mold, right? You are effectively selling a low margin product where every single month you have to re-earn every single customer that you have. Obviously, I'm eliminating some recurring subscription stuff like that. And so first, it's really, really just that dynamic. That is a hard business to manage, low margin, no recurrence. And then you get to is your ability to actually get big tickets. If you look at like Brazil's what, the sixth biggest economy in the world, but if you actually look at spending power, there's no spending power below like the bottom 80% of Brazilians have a really, really, really small spending power. And so you either have to go an incredibly broad, zero CAC, very low ticket type of consumer like Nubank in the first 10 years. Or you have to go towards higher ticket consumers, but there's just so few of them that's really hard to build a business on the backs of, right, people making like less, you know, I think to be in the top 20%, you only have to make like $15,000 a year. So the top 15%, you're getting people who are like dramatically below minimum wage levels of the United States. And there's only 40 million of them, right? It's effectively like the size of, you're thinking the size of this, like Brazil from a high ticket consumer good is like the size of like Poland. It's really small, right? And so for those two reasons, right? It's like low margin, non-recurrence is bad. And then it's, you're either stuck with mega small tickets or larger tickets in smaller markets. So kind of choose your evil there. But I do think people go towards B2C because we're all consumers and people have a bias towards that. So I think in general, the B2B is where there are cooler opportunities because they're less obvious. And so you get less crowding around those opportunities because people don't inherently understand them as a user.
That makes sense. I mean, we can think like a consumer, but it's hard to think like a business unless we're operating the business.
100%.
Yeah. So you make this transition. Let's talk about, you know, those first months. You saw this opportunity. You didn't know the market was as big as it is, right? So it sounds like you thought, okay, we're going to focus on fleet. Did you have concerns that, you know, your TAM was too small? And then what were the first kind of 6 months? What did it look like? How did you face the, you know, kind of the unknown bureaucracy in this sector?
Early days back in like 2014, 2015, it was the wild, wild west, right? It's like the Cayman structure concept. You know, a lot of the problems that you guys are solving at Latitude, right? It's like how to flip into the Cayman structure. I was lucky enough to set up a Delaware LLC first. And I knew a lot of founders who didn't do that. And, you know, the flip is just awful. And man, from that phase, I'm sure it still happens today, but the quality of accountants who are willing to work with startups is just awful. Like every single person was like, yeah, my accountant screwed me. And they screw you just because they actually don't know what they're doing. An accountant willing to earn 2,000 hands a month for work is an accountant who's totally unqualified. And so you get a very, very complex tax regime that you know nothing about because you're a foreigner. And not an accountant, and you're dependent on highly unreliable accounting sources. So just trying to have those not blow up your business. I would actually say at the very earlier stage, it was impossible to open a bank account. That was the thing that took me longest to actually get my visa done. Was like all the banks were like, "No, we won't open up." I'm like, "I'm not asking for a loan. I just want to deposit money," and they said no. And I think opening up a bank account, it sounds like most of those problems have been solved today, right? It's like easy to do those things, but I mean, as you know, back in 2014, 2015, these were like gargantuan tasks that no one had a very clear like playbook for how to do these things. Like no one had. You just like, I remember the way I opened up my bank account was like Kimball from who had run baby.com and then Jinda. He was like, dude, I just know this guy and at Santander Pompeia. Here's his WhatsApp. Just call him. He like knows the way of getting it done. He just did. It was just like word of mouth. Like it was like everyone you chatted to was like a fixer. You just had to get like the right fix here to get your jobs done and stuff like that. It was very little thinking about business problems, a lot thinking about just the bureaucracy of getting things done.
It's crazy to me having access to someone that create a bank account is like a value add to a founder, right?
It's incredible.
Or like, hey, I know a lawyer that can help you. And then it's like, all of a sudden you're like creating an in for that founder. I remember as an angel investor, besides obviously the operational piece and, you know, having scaled the company and fundraising and all that stuff, I remember founders perceived it as value add for me to actually introduce them to Silicon Valley Bank back in the day. Something that, you know, people were really grateful that I was able to do as one of their first customers. I'm going to take a second because this feels like an opportunity for a completely shameless plug. You mentioned three things that are really interesting. You mentioned the company formation and the flip, which we're tackling. And now we've done, you know, 75 formations and came into Cayman, and founders have raised hundreds of millions of dollars. And then two, we actually just quietly launched our offshore accounts, business accounts, which we'll be publicly launching at Vamos Latam Summit. So those are two really important things. And then the third one, you mentioned accounting. No spoilers, but we are working on some products to help with tax filing and compliance. So not necessarily Brazil accounting, which, you know, we invested in B-Hub, and there's others that are solving that problem in Brazil. But it's actually really nice to hear all this. It reinforces all the pains that I think I saw and you saw, because we were in the early days of this ecosystem where it was so fragmented and difficult to provide reliable, you know, resources there. So anyways, thank you for the setup. This was not planned, but I appreciate you highlighting some of those things because we're trying to solve those.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I can't go an episode these days without asking about AI, and you're embedding that somehow in your business. What's the opportunity look like for your specific business? You have a ton of data, right? And so is this something that you're kind of on the sidelines and seeing how you utilize, or have you already started kind of coming up with some ideas to first see how you can create more efficiency in your operation, or where are you with AI?
Yeah, we will implement a few different things around AI. I actually say we use AI more around like marketing and automation of writing using, you know, LLM. But I don't think AI is going to have a massive impact on IoT. In general, have some impact, but it won't be transformational, right? It'll basically just help us because, remember, of the stack of hardware, firmware, and data streaming and software, you can only help on the software, right? Like AI is not going to make my hardware be better, faster, and stuff like that. And so we'll utilize as much as we can for automating a bunch of things that our end user wants, especially for our enterprise customers, which is the majority of the customers that we look at nowadays. We get a lot of demands that, hey, I want you to help me use all the data that you generate, but I don't know how to use this data. I'm not analytical enough to understand what I actually need to be implementing in a very large scale operation. I need you to help me with that. And so I think as we move into that territory, it's like creating better automation around the analytics of being a better ops. But of our actual tech stack, the complexity is unfortunately kind of currently outside the purview of AI, unfortunately.
Yeah, it sounds like most startups that are kind of proclaiming AI startups, really they're just doing what you just described, which is finding some kind of efficiency gains rather than, you know, being a straight kind of AI company. I'm just seeing a lot of pitches nowadays where it's like AI is at the center of the pitch, even though it's not really the center of the, you know, if you're going to automate something by using AI, you got to make sure the thing works first. It seems to be kind of an overstatement for most founders, but it sounds like you've got.
But insects fly towards the light, right? When that light is painted with AI, people will fly towards it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't think it's overhyped. I just think it's excessively applied to a lot of business thinking, and obviously fundraising and building an elegant narrative can be pretty destructive to how you think about your own business, right? Because what a VC wants to hear, what is a good business decision? There's a lot of conflict in that. And the fact that you just see the perfect example is the fact that, like, you know, I'm sure 80% of the decks you see have AI written on it, which is probably not a good business decision, but it is a good sales decision, right? And so you kind of end up not being the best, most efficient capital allocator after getting that cash.
It's hard to balance, right? Because, and like, I have regrets about this at Viva Rao, where we merged with our competitor and, you know, I was the chairman, and I think I've talked about this in the pod once before, where like SoftBank popped in and they're like, we're going to invest $250 million in the category. And I'm kind of like scrambling, like, fuck, what do they want to hear? You know, like, I mean, yeah. I don't want that money to go spread around to my competitors. So, you know, someday maybe I'll publish this video that we produced, which was like kind of talking about the future of real estate. And, you know, it's just like, it's a future that could exist, but it might be 30 years from now or 20 years from now. And so, you know, I think the founders need to be careful crafting their narrative around what investors want to hear. But at the same time, you can't have a blind eye to it because you're in a sales game too. You got to attract. So how do you strike the balance between like kind of weaving through what actually your business needs to do and what investors are attracted to?
I think it's just how to build an effective narrative, right? It's look, the best narratives are ones that just show metrics, right? The most powerful thing you can do is show traction, right? And so the more your narrative is just based around like, we actually are producing good numbers, that's the best narrative, right? As opposed to like, I don't know, I always kind of look down, I would say I'm kind of more behind scenes fundraiser and stuff like that. But it's, I always look down on these founders who are just like infinitely networking and stuff like that. Like, how is this a good use of your time, right? It's something that's really hard to build. The majority of people who try to build it fail, and you know, you're just networking at dinners and stuff like that. It can only go so far, right? Because to the investor, I can meet you today, and if I show you good numbers, you're going to get pretty excited about it, right? And so I'd say you should always over-index on your operation and under-index on the fundraising, right? The fundraising is a result of good operations, not vice versa. And so, you know, you can't have the tail wagging the dog here. I know, probably personal bias of mine. We definitely tried to raise money in 2018, got awful term sheets, ended up just continued bootstrapping until 2019 when we raised our first institutional round. Helped a lot that we had at the time a bunch of unicorns doing exactly what we're doing, sprouting up in the United States. So people are like, oh, this is super, super clear. In 2018, those unicorns hadn't been like yet anointed, you know, this mythical beast. Quite yet. And so our narrative is very hard. I remember some VCs were like, this is stupid. You're going to like monetize. You're going to throw the hardware in the trash can. You're like, well, no. you know, we can show you that or not, but they just like looked down and kind of scoffed at the business model until guys like Samsara and Keep Truckin' and Lytics became these like monster unicorns, you know, with billions of dollars from, you know, Andreessen and General Catalyst and all these sorts of companies. So I think we were very lucky that our narrative became extremely hyped up because of those players. But I think you have to be honestly true to what's good for the operation. The more you start like fibbing and painting things in a bad color, it's, you might win short term, but you're losing long term. So I actually think I do get the trade off, and I do get the fundraising and sales process. A sales process manipulation of the buying process, and if your buying process all pass lead through AI, you should find a different person to sell to.
Yeah. Shout out to Jason, you know, our mutual friend who I think you connected me with him, or you connected him with me. I don't remember, but who's, you know, led a few sessions, and he'll be at VLS talking about fundraising. He's, you know, he really is great on the kind of narrative crafting and kind of the, you know, the strategy piece on the fundraising side. So it's definitely something that like, you don't want to leave aside and not put energy into, but I subscribe to the same thing as you. If you're, you know, if you're one of these founders that's constantly fundraising, you know, you're neglecting your business, and then you're not going to have a business that, you know, is worth investing in. And, you know, you've raised from some great investors, and look, I think it's great when those founders, they go out and they struggle a little bit like you did in 2018 and you didn't knock it out of the park. And then you're able to go back to the drawing board and you executed well on your plan and your business. And, you know, the tides changed and the sector became more sexy. One, I think it's really funny how it's not sexy and you're dumb. And then all of a sudden, you know, a bunch of big names invest in the sector, and then all of a sudden you're brilliant. I felt the same about Bill in 2007, 2008, 2009, when I was looking at the market. And then when it did hit the cover of The Economist, and I was an idiot, and then I was brilliant. And then in 2013, I was an idiot again. And so I think the headline is just don't listen to external, you know, obsess about your customer and don't listen the VCs are not the tastemakers on what customers want. And so I think that that's the summary. But speaking of investors, you raise capital from, you know, Fifth Wall, IFC, SoftBank, and you raise in the 2021 environment, and then you also raise in 2023. Talk about how the bull and the bear markets varied in your process. What were the two processes like, and how would you compare that to where we are today?
Yeah. So, say the Series A for 2019 was kind of right when it started heating up, right at the very beginning. It was kind of like early 2019 was when like money actually started flowing into Brazil. And you know, we had a great investor at Fifth Wall. Fifth Wall led our Series A. We're excited about the terms and stuff like that. But that was I screwed up a lot of processing on that fundraise, but that was a very difficult fundraise, right? We did get a bunch of term sheets, but there was nose almost running out of money, like every piece of drama that you can imagine during a fundraise. And even the Series B was obviously a big success. Really happy that SoftBank led, super happy that Qualcomm also came into the round. But like we weren't like raining term sheets, and our numbers were awesome. And I think that the 2021 like mindset was everyone just wanted to like overfund the perceived winners. And they wanted these like rocket ship type stories. And it's very hard when you're trying to sell like SaaS to the enterprise, just because like you can be a really, really solid company that's, you know, doubles for a number of different years and create big outcomes, but like SaaS is less hype. I think that when money gets really rocky, it just goes towards B2C, where like I could grow, you know, 50x in a single year with users and stuff like that. And so I even think it was still hard to raise for SaaS companies at the time. But look, we did get a few term sheets. We got a great lead investor. And so the outcome is great, even though the Series A and the Series B, like, oh my God, there was some extremely, like, there's a ton of anxiety that was built in those processes. So I think the outcome was not fully descriptive of kind of the feelings that were behind those processes. And then with IFC coming in now, look, we were, you know, we kept growing pretty consistently, right? To us is the drop in funding was totally detached from our growth rate. What started out as an insider round, right? Like Qualcomm would want to put in a little bit more money than the existing investor, like, this is great. We'd love to like bolster the, increase your runway and put some more cash in the bank. And then IFC came in and said, we want to lead. So we're really excited about the valuation. The valuation was good. We now have a ton of money in the bank, three plus years of runway. And this one was a little bit easier just because we weren't like, we didn't go out to raise with a very limited, runway. It was much more of conversations and does this make sense? And so it was much more opportunistic. So it wasn't the same level of stress just because it wasn't like in 90 days, you stop paying your employees, which was the case in the Series A and the Series B.
I think the founders don't realize that is actually really common. And it like, unfortunately, like, you know, when you look from the outside, you're like, oh, raise the fat round, like, you know, Series A from Fifth Wall, global investor. But it's always the kind of retrospective when you look back, it's like people from the outside assume that it's just like smooth in the process. But I'd say that, you know, 90% of the time, it's not a smooth process. And in fact, also been an active angel investor. How many investments have you made early stage?
I think I've done between 20 and 25 early stage investments.
And what are you looking for when you invest? Like, why do you invest besides obviously the potential financial return?
Yeah, so I generally I try to stay close to things that I understand, right? Because like a seed investor, you're not like ripping through a data room and like, you know, following up on like how they think about the projections and stuff like that. Is that you're making a gut instinct type bet, right? To me, so I invest in B2B SaaS, anything automotive related, most things logistics related. I have very strong opinions around all three of those, lending related as well. And I mean, what I look for is, does the business make sense? Do I think that these guys can get product market fit pretty quickly? Are they pretty commonsensical? And then the founders, I have two big biases towards founders. I love founders that are first and foremost go to market related, right? I don't like technical founders. I don't like product-oriented founders who just have this deep emotional attachment to the product, just because when you are a sales-driven founder, you're much more dynamic. You're talking to your customer constantly. Every single sales call you have, whether it converts or doesn't convert, that is just profound learning. Why it converted, what are the loss reasons, et cetera. And what I found is that very sales-driven founders typically find that product market fit faster. And sometimes they can be ineffective at hiring the product team, but I find it's easier to get a product after having incredible customer intimacy than vice versa, right? Like, no one wants to be product out. Everyone wants to be customer in. So I have a big bias towards that. And then in general, I would say people who are just like you said before, it's like oblivious to risk and are just complete hustlers, right? It's just pushing that boulder up the hill constantly. That sort of profile, someone who's like really calculated about why they're starting a company and doing this and this and this, is not a very good profile, right? Because it means that the second things get hard, you do the calculation, it doesn't make sense to continue. And so those two things that I know, very, very sales driven, right? Go to market first, product second. And and people who just have an inherent hustle mentality to them and have an obliviousness to risk.
Do you think that there's, because your observation about like product tech versus kind of the sales, it's kind of the opposite of like YC or a lot of the Silicon Valley mantra. Do you think that there's something different about Latin America, or is that just a personal preference for you?
No, I don't think there's anything different about Latin America. I think it's personal preference. I think it's fancier to say like technical founders and stuff like that. I really don't like technical founders. Just because, startups are demand constrained, right? And you need someone to say, I understand how to unlock demand constraints. No one ever is like, oh, we had tons of demand, I just couldn't build the product. That like never happened. Whereas it happens all the time that like I built a beautiful product and no one bought it. And so I want people over-indexing on demand generation and customer intimacy, and then figuring out product along the way, right? Just because those are the traps that people typically fall into, is I just couldn't figure out how to get this into our customer's hands with good unit economics.
I like it. I mean, even Mark Andreessen, talks about distribution is more important than product a lot of times. So I think that, but you get this kind of like halo over technical founders. And, I find myself like biasing towards technical founders too. My co-founder, she was at Duolingo, which is, led by a super technical founder who was at Carnegie Mellon and, built Duolingo. And so there's obviously examples of breakout companies that are really big. You look at Google, you look at Facebook, you look at these. But I think for the most venture-backed companies, sales is the thing that drives the success of the company. And, you can play catch up on the product and tech side, but, if you're not, leading with like customer development and customer growth, it doesn't even matter. Right. That's your point.
Yeah. 100%. I think it's the customer orientation. Like, it's better if you have the sales dynamic, but you also are pretty technical. Yeah. I prefer that. Right. But in isolation, I've dramatically over-indexed towards the go-to-market first, right? Because product market fit is nice, but if you don't have product channel fit, it doesn't make any sense, right? Great. I love your product and solve the pain point, but if you can't distribute it with good unit economics, what are you achieving? Right. And so you can't think of those two things in isolation. You can't think of product market fit without product channel fit as the same thing. Like, what you build and the channel through which you distribute it, it's an element of the product itself. And so if you get highly technical people thinking about those in a siloed manner, you get clunky, very hard to distribute products.
I like it. I like it. It's well articulated, and I tend to agree with it. Let's wrap this up with the last kind of thoughts of, the future. What's, Cobly, what are you thinking about? What's next for you as a startup founder?
Yeah, man, it's, Vision with Cobly is pretty simple. Today we have about 80,000 vehicles in our base. We have the largest light vehicle telematics base in all of Latin America. And so we've been able to reach some pretty impressive scale. But look, we want 1 million vehicles in our base in the next 4 to 5 years. you know, and when we get there, we think we'll be a more than $5 billion company. So we're really excited about the future. And to us, it still is like our market is massive and still like 85% not penetrated at all, not even by like a family business or a big industrial incumbent, like nothing, right? And so we're still like competing against non-consumption, which is pretty exciting in a big region. And so to us is honestly, we just want to make our product more robust, launch a few more features here and there, but just get more of the major enterprise of Brazil into our base. And so it's honestly sell more to the same customer, right? Is very important to us. And that focus is incredibly important to us, right? I always get kind of heart palpitation when I hear a founder be like, oh, we're going to be in 9 countries and 3 products and 4 channels. Like when someone comes up to me and says, Parker, I have one product, which will be sold to one customer through one channel. I almost don't care what your business does. I mean, I love it. That level of focus is such an unbelievable superpower, both in the early days and at scale. Like I have, you know, Parker's like archaeological wandering mind. Like there's I have a million like little mini personal blog posts about cool products that I want to do and cool distribution I want to do. But you just have to get back to this is like, you have to be a focus factory of capital allocation at almost every single point in the biz. And so to us is that continue to focus on our customer, one channel, one product, one customer. And, you know, then the balance of velocity and capital efficiency. And if we weigh those two things pretty effectively, we can have 1 million cars in our base in the next 5 years.
Love the focus. Love the, you know, kind of single-mindedness of like, this needs to happen. That's how you unlock a lot of value. And so thanks for sharing some of your thoughts with us on the pod today.
Let's do it, man. Great chatting.
Thank you for listening to Latitude Podcast. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast for more talks with great founders and investors. I'm your host, Brian Reckworth. Vamos Latam. See you next week.